Hi, I'm Liz Lamford, arts correspondent for ArtSound FM, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Rosalind Lemieux. Rosalind was born in Sierra Leone and makes extraordinary sculpture and object-based works. After graduating from the ANU School of Art in 2007 with honours, she has gone on to be a national finalist and exhibit internationally. Her work is held in public and private collections in Australia and the UK. Rosalind also collaborates with galleries and artists to publish written work in print and online that provides insight into the creative practices of contemporary practitioners. Rosalind, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Can I start with a question that takes us right back to your early days? What is the first piece of art that you remember creating?
Yeah, sure. The first piece for me was when I was about 14. So my father had a friend, which was part of his philosophy group. Her name is Helen Leet. She's still a practicing sculptor in Sydney. And she allowed me to be in her garden. She had a ceramic studio. And I think that's the first time I was, I suppose, in that space of making, having this kind of open time and kind of losing myself in a practice and kind of finding clay. And so I made a bust. It was kind of very muscular. Helen's style is perhaps much more, I guess, lyrical and stylized. And the work that I did, I just want this really big neck of a woman who's kind of looking up at the sky. And I remember kind of clawing my hands in the clay to kind of get her muscles as she's kind of straining and looking, and it's kind of pensive, but yeah, and it had like a metallic glaze on it, but it was quite immediate, and I still have it. And yeah, that was probably the first, I feel like when I say work that was made, because it had such a strong intention, expression, and also, I guess, falling in love with the material. Yeah.
That's so lovely. Was art a significant part of your life growing up?
Yeah, my family is very much into the arts. So, you know, there's always classical music in the background constantly. My sister is a pianist, Tonya Lemieux, and my other sister is a singer as well. So she was a classical singer. And so everyone, you know, there's always books around, there's always music playing. And at the moment now with sort of kids and such, someone's always playing the piano or singing a tune or doing a drawing of, you know, a sort of a space monkey or whatever it is. And I think, yeah, there's a huge kind of creative life and interests in the arts, literature, theatre, dance, music is huge in our family, and it's really informed who we are as, yeah, individuals, but also it's definitely part of our family identity. So, yeah, massive us, yeah.
And as an artist, how did you find getting to input into the design and build of your gorgeous, light and art-filled home that we're catching up in today?
Yeah, well, so Gundaroo, we landed in Gundaroo, which we absolutely adore, and my partner Damien, who also does photography, had a huge kind of, I guess, input into the design in terms of function. Damien's all about function. I'm super into materials and aesthetics. Our house kind of has a gal exterior, so galvanized iron. So it's kind of got quite a gritty industrial look. We're in a heritage zone, so we're sort of referencing the sheds, I suppose, wool sheds that are really kind of iconic in this area. But yeah, it's tricky with houses because you're kind of looking at form and you're looking at scale and you're thinking about spaces and how you want to live. But you're also, for Damien, for instance, he's all about solar passive energy efficiency. What does the future hold if the world shuts down? And can you be a solar island or whatever the phrase is? So it's kind of it's really a collaboration, this house. And I think we trusted each other a lot on it. There's definitely things we would change, as with anybody, but I think ideas around kind of like consistent palettes when you're looking at sort of the backgrounds of things. We've got a lot of grays and blacks, which we really love, but then there's also a lot of light that comes into the home because we're kind of northeast facing. So yeah, we've got like a hallway gallery, which we've got sort of works that I've made over the time, and friends have given us, and friends have made as well. We've got a beautiful Tony Tuxen in the hallway, which is just gorgeous. I did a little bit of work for Margaret Tuxen actually when I was about 14 as well,
Right.
and she gifted that to me when I was 21. So some really sort of precious objects. And I think the thing with a home, I suppose, is when you're kind of creating a family and memories, and a practice is for life. So I think, art and life are really together. And this home is absolutely still in progress, I will say, but it's been informed by, I think both of our experiences and our kind of knowledge of, art and science and energy and all those things.
Honestly, it's just got such a lovely, warm feel, well-being art gallery. Quite stunning, and it does really reflect those personalities of you both, which is just lovely. That brilliant family feel to it as well. Have you had any memorably funny, unusual, or unexpected things happen during your artistic studies and work as both an artist and arts writer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's lots and lots of moments. And I think part of it is just, I don't know if this is an artist personality thing, or perhaps it's just me, but I often kind of, I lose track of time. That's something that I sort of struggle with. I forget dates sometimes. I overestimate how heavy things are, which is very tricky when you're doing sculpture. So I remember, at art school, I had like a 20 kilo bag of plaster, and I was like, oh, I can fit this on my bike. Like, no worries. Couldn't drive at that time. My bike just like fell on the floor, not going to go anywhere. I've had times when I was making some antlers, and it was the back of the trailer. I was moving studios at 2 a.m. as you do. And it flew off the back. So, we were sort of on the highway picking up all these bits of antlers. There was no
Oh,
traffic, thank goodness. But Damien just looked at me like, we're doing this again, aren't we? And yes, Damien, we're doing this crazy, crazy thing again. So yeah, I think but I think it's sort of part of the it's part of the artistic perhaps mentality or way of being in the world, because I think you kind of always hope and strive for the best of things. And when you fall in love, sometimes you're not always thinking. I think that happens to me quite a lot. So yeah, definitely.
what led you to work with sculpture and concrete in particular?
Yeah, I think with sculpture, going back to that sort of earlier point about I guess finding how in love I was with the material of clay in particular is where it sort of begun for me. I sort of realized that, when I'm drawing, I did life drawing for many years and I really loved that too. But I realized what I loved about it was the materiality of the charcoal and the paper. And I also, find myself trying to scratch through the paper. And it's kind of the 2D, I just can't do just 2D. I always want to kind of reach for more. And I love textures and ripping and kind of surfaces and that kind of thing. So it's sort of a natural, I guess, mode for me in terms of how I express my work. But in terms of sculpture, when I went to the art school, ANU sculpture workshop. So I guess learning techniques of casting was really, I guess, quite transformative for me, because it was a way of recreating the world and suddenly making, a cabbage into concrete. And what does that mean? I mean, you can just sit on that for hours about what the kind of concept is of when something that is in the world is transferred into something other. And I think that kind of permanency with concrete is really exciting. Concrete's also much cheaper. So I did some bronze work when I was at uni at art school, which I really loved. And I'm hoping to do more bronze as well this year or next year. Working on some waxes at the moment. But I think it's just that process of transformation is really what's so exciting and thrilling and sort of conceptually really satisfying for me.
The other thing that I'm just so keen to talk to you about is your interesting travel experiences. How have these influenced your work?
Absolutely. I think during art school, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to travel through Spain and look at a lot of the sort of museum collections there of still life, especially at the Prado in Madrid, which is just incredible. I think the thing with travel is that you see art in context, and especially in Europe, you sort of you see the crumbling building, you see the sandstone blocks that have been handmade as you walk up the steps, that have also been hand carved, and then you enter the museum, and and seeing works with such a long history as well, it was really, really sort of fascinating. But I think the kind of the history, the depth of collections has been really interesting for me. I did a gap year when I left school as well. That was my first sort of big travel experience. So I worked in a school when I finished year 12, and I went overseas, lived in England, and I traveled in my holidays. And I got to kind of backpack all around Europe. And that's where I really, and my whole reason for doing that was just to check out as many kind of museums and galleries as I could possibly see. And it was, there's nothing like seeing art out of books and in real life, and but also seeing the institutions that kind of hold those and the context and the history. So, it just, I think it cemented for me how real art is. I know that sounds sort of odd to say, but when you're kind of 18 in Australia, I think it can feel a little bit like it's in books and, not everybody's necessarily interested in it, but I really felt like I was, I suppose, at a really exciting time, feeling like I'm living in the present, but there's this huge kind of history of expression and ideas. And that was just so thrilling for me. And that sustained me for a really long time. So, a fantastic experience.
Where do you draw your artistic inspiration from? I personally wonder where your ideas came from for some of my favorite pieces, including your perfectly replicated concrete carpe diem fish and the longer stay boots.
So again, working with concrete. So the longer stay boots came out of a series from art school. So I was really obsessed with castings. So I do silicone mold making, and I would just cast everything I could. So, cast a dead bird, was casting fruit and vegetables as well, lots and lots of sort of organic things. But I remember I think I was doing actually the residency at ANU Sculpture, and I had my old boots, which had kind of seen me through my years, and they were, my blundstones were falling to bits, and I was just like, yes, these are ready to go. So, took them off and made a mold of my old art school boots. So I suppose, it's not just, it's the object. Yes, it's the object of a boot, and it's cast concrete boots with sort of gold leaf on the bottom with one tipped over. But it's also, it's a personal object, and it's been worn, and it's sort of this idea of that you can kind of trawl through a day, and especially sort of industrial environments and workshops and that kind of thing. The gold on the bottom of the boot is sort of like you can stumble into those ideas, and that's the kind of shine of the day that you kind of exist on. So I think that's where that kind of came through. I did a series of those boots, and they were all in kind of different iterations. And casting's quite interesting in the sense that you can replicate and duplicate, but in that, you can kind of question different aspects of a thing. And in that case, it's questioning what is the boot and what does it mean to be wearing those, day in, day out, and how do they function in your kind of, the days when you want to present yourself, the days when you're really tired, the days when things are cracking and you're just, or the days when it's really dusty and you're just sort of, can't get it together or whatever. So I think it definitely became a bit of a metaphor. And then Carpe Diem was I did that for Contour 556, which is like a Canberra art biennial that's done by Neil Hobbs and Karina Harris. It's really, really fantastic festival of sort of public art and installation, and contemporary practice as well is really the focus. And I was walking around the lake, Lake Burley Griffin, with Neil. We were talking about what Contour was coming up, and he has a really fantastic relationship with a lot of local artists, and they're both amazing just in the sense of, I guess, allowing you to be off leash. So that's really, that kind of creative freedom is just so important. But we were just walking, and I walked past a row of dead carp on the side of the lake, and I sort of said, "Oh my God, that's amazing." And I said, "That's it." And he went, "Oh, okay, that's it." And it's out of those moments, I think, an art practice or artworks often come out of moments of conversation or kind of connections with people, or and that's the beauty of it. It's not separate to life. It's always infused with it, and it's a part of it. So, yeah, that's where that one came from.
Who are some of your favorite artists?
Louise Bourgeois is massive, mega, amazing. She's like, oh, everything you need. So she was a French artist. She worked for a long time in New York. She did the incredible mother sculpture with those big bronze spiders that kind of take over city squares and things. And I think I saw her work in Louisiana when I was visiting my sister, Tonya. And so Louisiana has a really amazing contemporary arts program. And I didn't know Louise at that time. It's when I was sort of backpacking in my holidays to get my fix of, museums and galleries in Europe. And yeah, I remember sort of going through this exhibition and just kind of realizing that this person was a canon, and yet I did not know of them previously, and all my studious kind of trawling of art books, through high school and things like that. And I think it's her. She's so kind of female, personal. Her work kind of leans into confessional art. It's quite psychological. It's very there are sort of domestic aspects of it in terms of using like thread and fabric and handkerchiefs, but also bronzes and marbles. And yeah, she's just like one of my all-time bedrock. If I'm ever sort of unsure, I will go back to Louise. And actually, a really dear friend of mine, Jacqueline Bradley, who's a phenomenal artist, we're just like Louise is first person because she's like the beginning of it all. So she's incredible. Oh, and then Kiki Smith is another artist that is just amazing, and she's sort of different to Louise. Yeah, she has a sort of, I guess, more of a folk kind of mythological aspect to her work. Naive's the wrong word. It's not surreal, but again, I guess it's that kind of emotional, the emotion in her work is quite palpable, and she does sort of, drawings that are soaked in Indian ink with kind of night animals scrawled onto them, or the cast organs, a lot of abject art as well, like someone, like a woman made of wax with kind of red beads coming out like a period. So yeah, she kind of has this really interesting, abject, beautiful, yeah, sort of just incredible, incredible materiality, but also, I guess, a really strong artistic voice. And I think the thing that I love about both of those artists is their sense of freedom in who they are and in their work. And that's something that I think is actually kind of can be hard, because art can be intensely personal, but it's also, of course, it's exhibited and it's shown. So, the kind of the thin skin of artists, which is always there, is kind of, yeah, that can be really tricky to navigate. And I think they're just very brave, but also just phenomenal in their output and their work. Yeah. Oh, anyway, sorry, swoon moment, but yeah, definitely.
They're both extraordinary.
Yeah, extraordinary artists. Yeah.
One of the other things that I was really keen to touch on with you is whether you're able to walk us through how and where you create your work and source your materials, and what is involved in the artistic process of molding concrete and creating objects and sculptures.
Yeah, sure thing. So I have worked with some found objects, so and I source them from all sorts of places. It can be markets, it can be things that I just find around as well. Certainly in uni, at an art school, there'd be a lot of like old tools was a huge thing for me. I did a series on tools, and I think the you sort of start finding objects that you're attracted to because you're obsessed with a particular thing. You only realize that afterwards, of course, like all great artistic endeavors. You never know when you're in it, but I think, retrospectively, you kind of understand that you've had like a massive tool phase or casting the body phase. And I think it's, so often it's things that are around me. Sometimes I get really just, I fall in love with a particular idea. And so it kind of just comes to me and I just, I go and source that thing. But for me, I suppose finding that line between, what is kind of made or what I put my hands on to create, and then what is found, and getting that kind of getting those two objects to kind of merge or transform and become something new is to me the art of it. And sometimes I think with art, you can, you're sort of on this like frontier all the time of discovering. Not discovering, because that is such a problematic world, but I guess you're looking for something to articulate that you perhaps haven't seen before, or that is new to you, that you haven't seen in your in exhibitions or reading or anything like that. And when you're trying to understand something new, it can feel sort of, I guess, strange because you don't know what this thing is, So that's sort of. But I think that's the most exciting thing. And when you kind of, with contemporary practice, that is the art of it, is when it's something that's slightly uncomfortable because you're not sure what this kind of new beast is that you've created, but it's kind of a new object of expression. And concrete has been, I think with sort of molding and casting, it's just been a material that I've had for a really long time. And so I've used kind of moving into white concrete now, stretching out and using oxides and things to kind of do a bit more marbling in the concrete. And I'm really enjoying that because I guess I'm shifting into gesture. So at the moment, I'm really interested in how does a material kind of hold gesture and movement, but still be static. And that's interesting and kind of links into my kind of previous, I guess, work around still life, which is transforming something that is living into something that is inanimate, or casting concrete, the concrete cabbage, metaphor. But so this kind of new world for me is absolutely about how does gesture get kind of imbued in your work, and that's what I'm really excited about.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And just, such a wonderful material to work with. It's quite interesting to watch the way that you make it transform.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's such a good point. And it kind of links back to, Art de Povero is something I was really, it's one of my sort of favorite art movements, and particularly around sculpture. I think it's just that materiality and that kind of investigation of materials and what they are and what they really are. It's kind of pulling back the screen of the kind of museum, that museum kind of veneer. And so yeah, it's just poor materials. It's such a basic material. You see it everywhere, but how can you make something that is so kind of banal into something that is worthy of your time to look at and to live with and kind of inform your life or to ponder what this whole thing is about. So yeah, definitely.
Are there sort of unique challenges around drying times and prepping silicon molds and things like that you've discovered throughout your practice?
Yeah, definitely. I'm pretty particular about my silicon. So, and there are definitely some sort of curing agents you can do to kind of, boost things up. Like if you're doing a dead bird in summer, don't recommend that anybody You want to cure that thing not over 3 days, but like as quickly as you can. So definitely you can sort of, there are additives you can do to the silicon because it is a it's a chemical process. So you can sort of the ratios for that you'd be quite specific with. But you essentially, you put the silicon on, make a clay kind of base, then you put the silicon on over the top, and then you make a mother shell, which is the plaster with some hessian if you need to reinforce it. And then you flip it, and then you do the other side. And casting is, it's quite a process because essentially you have to, you always have a seam line because you're creating a negative space of this object. So it can get quite technical. I've definitely had lots of casting fails, but over time you kind of realize what works. And I'm using a lot of grout at the moment and kind of a swimming pool concrete as well, which is the white. And that's, slightly different ratio. And when it's more watery, you might not get a good lip or a good kind of edge. So you have to be quite sort of mindful of that. So yeah, and how much grit and detail will come to the surface and all those sorts of things.
What are some of the practical challenges involved in safely transporting your work to national and international exhibitions and purchases? I imagine there'd be some significant challenges that can be quite a fragile product or a heavy product
Yes.
sometimes.
Yes. And it's, I think there's a bit of a joke, artists, where, you'll always fall in love with the big, awkward thing or the really fragile thing. You're like, why do you have to choose that to, send halfway across the world? And I've sent an I-beam across the world. Why did I send an I-beam? It had to be the I-beam. No, packing and freighting is huge. And I would love actually to kind of learn how to make my own kind of crates, because that's the crate industry is an amazing one that I would love to crack, particularly for sculpture because it is so heavy. So I do kind of, I feel my limitations in terms of strength and size. When you're working with really, works that are over 100 kilos, I don't have a crane, that kind of thing. So it can be really, really tricky and very, very expensive. So it does kind of, I think, unfortunately, limit you sometimes. So but when I had my first baby, I definitely kind of, my scale reduced when I was making. I was definitely, I was kind of at home a lot more, and I could really only do small things at that time. And so it was, miniatures amazing, but large scale so difficult. It's a whole other ball game.
Far out. That's just such an interesting insight into what goes into actually getting large and fragile artworks to exhibition and to purchases. I'm sure there's a whole insurance aspect as well, but the admin behind the art, it's important.
It is absolutely, absolutely. And my partner is really into weightlifting, as is his friend, and they are very, very useful people to know when you
Hand in
make large
glove.
concrete sculptures. There's a bit of a bit of, can you please, 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 and a bit of a roll of the eyes. But yeah, so you definitely need help.
One question that I was also really intrigued to ask you about is whether it's ever challenging for you to sell or gift your favorite works.
Yeah, it is a bit of a tricky one, but I think as you practice kind of, over a period of time, perhaps like as an emerging artist, I definitely felt like there were things like, oh, I can't possibly give that up. And you might weigh it up as, well, how much am I going to get from my waitressing gig versus how much I can sell that for? So yes, actually, I will sell that, and that's definitely a consideration. But I think now, not so much. And I'm really interested in, I guess, making works that have ideas and intention behind them. So it's less sad to me. And if someone can, live with something and love it, just like I love living with art, it's really important to me. It definitely kind of fills my day and my mind and my kind of emotional state. And I think that's great. I think you're just contributing to like that broader kind of, art family, for want of a better word. So yeah, no, definitely. It's fine.
That's such a generous attitude as well to it, that other people will also get joy and and just adore these pieces.
Yeah.
That must be incredibly
It
satisfying.
is. It is, definitely.
What advice do you have for artists who are starting out? What do you wish someone had told you if they didn't, or if they did, what did they tell you?
There's so much, isn't there? Because I think art school, you go through the theory and you're establishing your kind of your practice and your expression and learning so many new things, but definitely that sort of arts admin, the spreadsheet. I'm not a spreadsheet person. I know some people are. Some of my good friends are spreadsheet people, and I think that's incredible. But it's taken me a long time to understand just how much you need to kind of catalog, keep a track of works and their dates and who you've sold things to, and the time frames and even condition reports and things like that. Tax time. We're on tax time now. I have not done it yet, but I will soon. Keeping receipts and things like that, getting smart about sort of, I guess, a business aspect of it. And I think for some people, that's quite contentious in terms of, my art is not a business or a brand. And I completely understand. But I think kind of the mechanics and the admin ground is something that takes a lot more time. And if you can get good at it, it's actually helpful. But I think the other thing is just, really like investing in your community is so important. So your peers at art school, they're going to stay with you for decades. So, and that's such a special sort of relationship. And the people you meet along the way, the people that you might do shows with, curators, writers, other artists, it all kind of feeds into your extended network. And that network is a lifeline for you if you things happen or even not. I think it's just when you love art so much and you have people that also are so passionate about it, it's just the best thing. So I think investing in your people is really, really important. Yeah, in your community.
So true. What have been some of the best exhibitions that you have ever attended?
Louise Bourgeois, which I spoke about before, just like, yeah, like changed the course of my kind of, I guess, yeah, internal art life. It just shifted everything. So, yeah, changed the narrative, definitely. But I was at CCAS last night and, Bodies Without Organs, curated by Angela Lockhead. It's sort of about queer artists and queer art. And it's really interesting seeing a lot more exhibitions about kind of identity and representation and sort of artists from different kind of mediums and modes coming together around grappling around this idea of, identity is super fascinating. So yeah, I love the Canberra Contemporary Art Space exhibitions are really super cool. So their program.
In your view, what makes a good exhibition?
Oh, that's
Another topic, because it can depend on so many
yeah,
factors.
it does. I think good exhibition is one that sort of can take you by surprise and one that you can enter into and you feel like you can enter into it. I think sometimes exhibitions can be really inaccessible for people, actually, whether that's through kind of, they're too theoretical or, I just think sometimes they're not as open as some artists might think themselves. But I think, yeah, for me personally, I mean, sculpture show, if you're kind of, investigating materials and materiality, I just like live for that. So I love to when there's sort of you are kind of moved somehow by an artist's intention. You see things differently after kind of seeing their work. And the kind of mode of expression is kind of brave. I really enjoy that. So that's something that kind of gives me, bolsters me up and sort of, I don't know, I think it makes you feel like it's all okay and all the kind of raw edges are fine and that's what life's about. So, yeah.
I think that's so true, that honesty and that bravery.
Well, there's always that interesting point, isn't there, between sort of balance and control. And I
Yeah.
think when you feel like that balance is exciting, like you're kind of sitting on the knife's edge of it, that can be really kind of exhilarating because you don't, for me personally, I don't want to see things that are safe or kind of necessarily overcooked, but I want to be challenged, but I want to see that sense of freedom. And I think you can definitely see that in an exhibition when you kind of walk in. So yeah, definitely.
Even Mona, just incredible. And yeah, just every corner that you turn throughout that extraordinary building.
Yes.
With the amazing views out over the water as well.
And a subterranean kind of cavern of art. Yeah. Yeah.
And just the way that they play with light open spaces and then darker enclosed spaces so effectively.
Yes, yeah. It's very dramatic. Oh, definitely. God. And that's it, right? It's sort of, you know, life and death, beauty and decay. It's kind of all kind of there and you experience this kind of, yeah, kind of great soaring between states, which is, I don't think you get that from anything else, you know? So yeah, and it's experience based. It's kind of visceral. You respond to it, your body responds to it, your mind is shifted. And I think that's, yeah, so just so incredible. I think that's what art kind of gives you, you know, when it's at its most powerful and at its best.
Can you talk me through your process of reading objects?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, objects, it's so interesting to think your body is an object in space. I think, you know, you're sort of 101 with sculpture is that you are an object. So your relationship to other things in space is one that is based between two objects in space interacting. And, you know, that's a kind of base point. We have a ground plane, we are vertical, you know. You read things that are kind of long as portrait and you read things that are horizontal as landscapes. Your eye kind of goes to, I guess, the mechanics of things and how you might, you know, if something's at chair height, you might want to sit on it. If it's soft, you might want to touch it. And then I think, you know, objects, and when you're shifting with materiality, it kind of pushes the boundaries of those things and those expectations. And that's, I think, where things get really kind of exciting and interesting. And kind of your expectations. I mean, you expect metal to be hard, you expect concrete to be hard, but when it's cast in something soft, you know, you sort of want to do a double take and you kind of wonder if it could be a body, but it's not. And then if it's a body, should it be animated? But it's actually inanimate. And so I think your brain kind of does all these switches around the kind of expectations of things and how your body is used to responding to its environment, and whether that's through kind of scale, texture, light, you know, all those sorts of things. All your kind of sensory inputs are really sort of heightened, I think, with objects. But yeah, I think with sculpture, you know, in contemporary sculpture as well, and contemporary sculptural practice, I should say, because spatial practice and performance is such an intrinsic part to it now too, and kind of takes into that idea of, you know, time-based aspect, that fourth dimension of time as well. But it's something I think we are getting better at reading and understanding, as opposed to kind of the pictorial, you know, two-dimensional picture view, if you will, of, you know, a painting on the wall. I think we're getting better at being more literate with sort of sculptural objects and what they mean. So yeah, it's it's sort of fascinating how you read and interpret things, but also with your own body, your own relationship to things and your expectations. Yeah.
The other thing that I was curious to talk to you about are some of the fascinating developments that we're seeing in contemporary art.
Yeah, I think especially since COVID, I think things have really shifted. So I think online platforms, socially engaged kind of practices, collaborations across kind of different art forms, I feel like there's a lot more openness around that, and that's quite exciting to kind of see. And there's also, you know, global markets are shifting as well, so you know, and that's all through, of course, online as well. I feel like contemporary practice, you know, we were talking about the fourth dimension before and sort of performance-based, installation-based works, site-specific works, even kind of our own understanding of country and, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander knowledge, and sort of traditions and customs that have kind of informed where we today or how we conceive of ourselves as present, but we're also actually future as well as past. What's your concept of time? Is it, you know, is it sort of linear or is it circular? So I think, you know, because of that kind of expansion, we're sort of seeing a lot more diverse voices in contemporary art, which I think is super, super exciting. And you know, it's not fully inclusive because I think we still have so much work to do across all of that. But you know, LGBTIQA artists and spaces and representation and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and people with disability and all of that, women, yeah. So it's kind of expanding. And as we were talking about before, with, you know, you essentially, for me anyway, and this may be my own assumption here, but you start with your self or your body as an object in the world, as a thing that exists. And you know, it kind of beckons that question of if you are different, if you are or you have kind of diverse experiences, then that's kind of, you know, feeds into, I guess, what contemporary practice could be when we talk about contemporary in relation to, I guess, an art tradition that we have kind of known a westernized kind of, you know, European art tradition primarily. So yeah, I feel like expanded practice is, it's an open field and it's exciting, and all the AI that's happening and you know, sort of ideas around authorship and censorship, and yeah, so it's fascinating. Yeah.
It sure is. Goodness. No, so many really interesting things happening in that space and great opportunity as well.
Yeah, definitely.
You have had so many extraordinary exhibitions and accolades. What would your dream artistic collaboration or opportunity be?
Yeah, I think so I'm really looking forward to the Glassworks residency coming up in October with Canberra Glassworks. I'm super, super, super pumped to have that opportunity. And really, you know, that's just kind of 5 or 6 weeks of getting to know the material of glass, which is completely new to me. I think it's phenomenal that the Glassworks is kind of opening up to, I guess, you know, local and interstate and international artists as well, into their program and kind of the world of glass. So that's super, super exciting, especially, I guess, when you're like a materials nerd or you're just obsessed with materials and how they shift and what that means. So I'm really excited for that sort of coming up for myself. And a recent collaboration that I've really, really enjoyed is writing a catalogue essay for Jos Kitson and her upcoming show. All will reveal itself when you dive in and dive in deep at Sophie Gannon Gallery in Melbourne. And it's just been such a pleasure to kind of work with her, see her works in the studio, and get back to, I guess, that idea of artistic exchange where, you know, sometimes I think when you are an artist, you work on your own works, but sort of working with others who might articulate different things for yourself, or seeing things differently and turning them around is really exciting. And it's kind of the fuel that kind of, you know, keeps your veins kind of, you know, yeah, pumping, I suppose, and sort of feeds your creativity. So, yeah, writing has been a huge, I guess, or an emerging, but also huge and exciting kind of part of my practice. I've always written, but I guess doing a bit more writing for artists and that kind of thing in magazines and things, newspaper articles has really been another way of processing, I suppose, artistic practice. But yeah, I think for me, I would just love the opportunity to do more shows and more exhibitions, and got a studio space at home, so that's super exciting. And setting up a bit more for that, and we've got Contour 556. I think that's next year that that's happening, but there's a panel discussion happening in July, so I'm really excited to be a part of that and sort of talk with kind of artistic, you know, colleagues and friends, and kind of really talk about, yeah, the state of play. So yeah, there's lots of exciting things and lots of opportunities, and I'm super open. I would love to travel again. So it's all kind of open at this stage, but definitely some things ahead and some really exciting things that I've been really grateful to be a part of as well.
Just sounds like an extraordinary range as well. And that's what I love so much about your practice is not only do you create these extraordinary artworks and put them out into the world, but you are such a generous supporter of other artists as well, which I just hugely admire in your writing and in the work that you do in that sort of critical space as well. And you just come to it with, yeah, just such generosity, such a spirit of really wanting to help promote others. And the way you speak about your arts colleagues as well, that you went right through your study and training with, and everybody who has sort of been fortunate enough to sort of be in your orbit has, it really does speak volumes about you. I'm really keen to pick your brain a bit and get some of your views around arts criticism and your role in exploring and examining the art of others.
Yeah, definitely. So I think in writing for other artists, and I know some people, art criticism is a bit of a contentious subject because there's absolutely not a camp, because that's the wrong term, but I think there are sometimes views that, nobody's critical anymore. Nobody wants to say anything negative anymore, or kind of just call a spade, or it wasn't even a spade, and they called the show a spade, and whatever. So I think sometimes there can be a little bit of, I think the role of art criticism is kind of going through a bit of scrutiny at the moment. But I think for me personally, the thing that I most enjoy is collaborating with other artists and getting a chance to kind of, I guess, see their own process and their own understanding of themselves and their works. And I think, I'm much more, I have a much sort of longer view now, I suppose, than when I first came out of art school. And I think for sustainable kind of arts practice, which we want to see and we need in Australia, if you want to hit the global stage and if we want a kind of thriving arts kind of pulse here, then I think it's really, really important that we kind of open it out for each other and support. But also, the gift of writing, I suppose, is that you can explain things for people that they may not be able to access for themselves potentially. And I find that really exciting, but also, I honestly, it's just such a joy to do it. And the article or the piece of writing is kind of almost, extra or excess to that kind of collaboration or that point of connection that I can kind of have with an artist, which I just really, I really enjoy. So yeah, it's been such a, it's been a really sort of fulfilling other aspect of my practice. And also, we spoke about that kind of contemporary arts community and wanting to really see that kind of blossom here, I think. And I think writing is just another mode, just as interviewing and talking is as well. So I'm sure there's lots of people in their studios right now, busy making. And yeah, I just think that's fantastic. So it's all part of it.
Rosalind, thanks so much for joining me. You have been listening to Liz Landford, arts correspondent for ArtSound FM, speaking with Rosalind Lamo.
Thanks so much, Liz. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.